Good afternoon. As is usually the case, we will be appearing at this time every day for the next few days. And for some of that time, not all of it, we'll be talking about meditation. And meditation we'll be talking about will not be the one that is described in that pamphlet you've been given. They still do that. They give you a little foldable pamphlet which has some description of a meditation technique. But we'll be looking at a different form of meditation, a different style. It still uses breathing, so it uses the same meditation object. But it's rather more, how shall I put it, complete than the one you've been given. If indeed they still give you that leaflet, I believe they do. That's years and years old, that thing's been flying around for centuries, it seems. Quite where the explanation comes from in the pamphlet, in that little pamphlet, I really don't know. The one we're going to be looking at is called Anapanasati. Anapanasati, this is a standard Buddhist meditation technique. In fact, the most basic one. Well, not quite, there is another one which is still more basic, but not particularly suitable to people who have to live in the world and do things other than live in monasteries, etc. But it's a standard Buddhist offering, and as long as I've been around this place, and for some considerable time, before I came here, these retreats were taught in this way. Anapanasati was the meditation instruction given. In days gone by, we used to really give the whole thing in great detail. It is quite a complicated practice if you hear it all in one go, at one time. There's not much point in doing that, really, because most people, if not all people, won't really be able to get much further than the very beginnings of it during the 10-day course. You might get all the information, but of course it will be difficult to retain, and most of it difficult to understand, until you actually start to get the practice itself to work in its beginning stages. And then of course it's much easier to understand what the whole technique is about. Anapanasati. Anapanasati. The interpretation of this into English is mindfulness with breathing. Anapanasati, three words basically you have there. Ana is in breathing. Apana is out breathing. Sati is mindfulness. Mindfulness. Breathing in, breathing out is very basic, and I don't think we need to make a big deal of explaining what breathing is. We do it all our lives. And normally we don't take any notice of it, unless we can't breathe very clearly, we have a cold, then we're aware of our breathing. That's about the only time we are. Or perhaps if we do some energetic exercise, and we feel out of breath, then we're aware of our breathing. But normally we don't pay much attention to it. Which is a shame, because it's, let's face it, the most important thing we have, really. We're alive, okay, mentally, physically, but without breathing, we wouldn't be alive for long. In ancient times in India, it was considered that breathing was something that could be developed on its own, without worrying too much about meditating. The actual business of breathing in and out could be done a lot more skillfully than people normally do it. And this would have a great effect on them, physically and to some extent mentally. So you shouldn't be surprised to hear that this is also a part of the practice of Anapanasati. Excuse me. It's not just about meditation straight, as meditation is normally understood. It's also about learning about the breathing, learning to use the breathing in a beneficial way, learning to breathe properly. Or as the Buddhists would say, skillfully. Normally we don't do this. Our breathing is pretty messy generally. Not well governed. Not well done. So we don't really get benefit from our breathing, the benefit we should get. The benefit we can get is extremely good health, very little illness, and an improvement in all our faculties. The better you can breathe, strange though it may sound, it's going to have an effect on the way you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. The breath of life, the breath is life, you can't live without it. So the more of it you get into yourself, the more skillfully you breathe, the better it's going to be for you. This is part of the practice. We'll get round to this in the fullness of time. We'll explain all these salient parts of anapanasati, mindfulness with breathing. We're going to focus on the beginning parts of it. We'll explain the whole practice, or at least we'll look at it. But we're going to be more concerned particularly with the beginning parts of the practice, because obviously these are the most important. But before we do that, let's take a look a little deeper at the practice itself, what it means, and what it's for, what it's supposed to do. But as mentioned, mindfulness with breathing, anapana, sati, three words put together, make the combination Pali word. Pali is the language of the Buddhist scriptures, by the way. A combination Pali word, anapanasati, mindfulness with or of in and out breathing. The version of this technique, because there are many explanations of how it should be done, the one we're going to be concerned with comes from this place, from Suan Mo, and from the founder of that place, which is the big monastery across the highway there, that you probably went to when you arrived, unless you came straight here. His name was Buddhadasa. It wasn't his monk name, that was a name he adopted. It means slave, slave of the Buddha. The Thai version of Buddhadasa is Putta That, or something like that. Putta is the Thai pronunciation of Buddha. That means slave. It can also mean other things, as most Thai words seem to. I didn't mean he became the servant of the Buddha himself. What he did was he enslaved himself to the Buddha's teaching, to explaining the Buddha's teaching in perhaps a more profound way than at the time when Buddhadasa was a monk it had been explained. This man was fairly radical in the way he functioned as a monk. He wasn't a strange monk. He was a very proper monk, one of the few very proper ones. But he had a very different understanding of just what the Buddha was teaching than is normally offered to people in Thailand. And this endeared him to some people and made him a figure of hate to others. He's dead and gone now, dead 20 years, so of course he's a great man now. He's out of the way, can't cause any more problems. It's his version of anapanasati we will look at and examine in some detail, particularly the beginning parts, because this is where Buddhadasa made certain changes to the way the technique was to be understood and practiced. He also looked at the entire Buddha's teaching. He enslaved himself to the Buddha's Dhamma, to explaining it as he thought it should be explained, instead of the superstitious business that it had been up to that time, which it continues to be even now. He tried to bring it down to earth, make it useful in life. Take the blind belief out of it and give it some basis in scientific understanding also. And this is what made him very unpopular, particularly his proclamations on things like rebirth, for instance, reincarnation, which is one of the things he investigated thoroughly and came to the conclusion that it was really nothing whatsoever to do with Buddhism. The Buddha was simply not teaching it. You can imagine that in a country like this, where Thai people support Buddhism because they expect to get something back from it. They expect to get reborn in a higher sphere by making donations to the Buddhist Sangha, the order of monks. They support the monks primarily for this reason, of course. obviously didn't make him too popular in this country when he came out and said the Buddha was not really not concerned with rebirth of the sort which people normally cling to as being a reality of life. He didn't say there was no such thing as rebirth. Wasn't that foolish? He just said the Buddha was not teaching it. And backed up his statement with many proofs. To this day, most people think that Buddhism is about rebirth. Those Westerners who become monks seem to have this kind of understanding. Not this particular one, but most do. And we'll look at all this in the fullness of time. He could be very controversial, and some of the things we're going to say, I'd ask you to remember now that they're not coming from me so much, although I'm saying them, they're actually coming from the man whose knowledge I have access to. It's Buddhadasa's teaching of Buddhism I'm going to be giving you, couched in English terms, coming through my organ of speech. And some of what we'll say could be quite disturbing for some people here, for sure. So back to the point of all this, anapanasati, mindfulness with breathing. Breathing is fairly straightforward, I think we don't need to bother explaining what breathing is. At least I hope not, because if you can't understand that word, you're in trouble. Sati, mindfulness, how about that one? Now, when I began to meditate about 4,000 years ago, I didn't have a clue what mindfulness was, and it never occurred to me for one moment to find out. So I sat down and watched my breathing. I assumed that somehow that was being mindful of breathing, which, strangely enough, it is. That's precisely what it means. It's the mental, putting it very simply without getting into a lot of difficult areas. It's simply the ability of the mind to observe, to pay attention to a particular object or experience it's concerned with, without losing it, without breaking up and thinking or imagining other things. It's not something you don't already have. It's not like you have to get it when you come here. You have it already. Mindfulness is a part of the human makeup. If you watch television, you must use mindfulness. The mind must be able to keep its attention on the object being observed. Otherwise, the television program couldn't make any sense. If you go watch a movie, for instance, or listen to music, and this is what keeps your mind, keeps your attention on the object, is the mind's ability to be what they call mindful. It's what enables us to live life at all, the fact that we can be mindful of the process of being alive. Unfortunately, we're not very good at that, because it's not particularly interesting or stimulating. What we are good at is being mindful of things that please and stimulate us. And as human beings generally, tend to spend their lives seeking these kind of experiences. This makes that kind of mindfulness very easy for us to acquire and develop. Unfortunately, that kind of mindfulness is no good when you come to meditate, because it's the opposite. It creates a disturbed state of mind on some level or another. It's easy to listen to music, particularly attractive, catchy music, and pay attention to it, because it stimulates, it pleases. And so the mind can very easily listen, and you can block everything else out and just be aware of the music until the music comes to an end. Sometimes you see a movie, perhaps, and this has the same effect. You sit there, you're conscious of your surroundings, but your mind stays on the object. It's so interesting. It's like you go to another place for a couple of hours. Then when the movie ends, your consciousness returns to its normal state. Your mindfulness shifts, changes. Your mindfulness is very strong when that kind of experience takes place. Now, when you read a very good book and it's so interesting, you really can't put it down. You don't want to do anything but read it. You can sit there for several hours just reading page after page after page and never losing your ability to concentrate on what you're doing. Because your mindfulness then is very strong. It holds the mind in place. That's why you can concentrate. A point we'll come back to in a moment. So if meditation was the same, if meditation was doable in the same way, if the mind could pay attention to, say, the breathing, in the same way it can pay attention to a movie, music, or anything stimulating, like sport or whatever, then it'd really be very easy to do. Unfortunately, it's not the case. The reason is that anything stimulating is just that, it stimulates the mind. It turns the human mind into a bit of a mess, excites it, delights it. And so the mind is very unstable, moving, fractured, not peaceful, not still, not quiet, not silent at all. Meditation requires a development of a peaceful mental state, a quiescent mental state, a concentrated mental state. Does concentration involve when you watch a movie, even though the movie is stimulating? There is a level of concentration, but that concentration never goes deeper than the surface level. You're always fully aware of what's going on around you. So you can concentrate on things like movies, but they tend to also bring, the mind state tends to be disturbed. That's not the purpose of meditation. Meditation is all about getting the mind into a peaceful condition. And a well-concentrated condition. In order to get the mind to concentrate on any level, on a movie, a book, on music, or even on a meditation object like breathing, mindfulness is essential. It has to be able to hold the mind steady for a continual period, for a longish period, for the mind to begin to really concentrate. This is what makes meditation difficult, the fact that the objects of meditation, because they're supposed to produce a peaceful state of mind, a concentrated, stateful mind, which is useful in the way of meditation. This is what makes meditation difficult to do. All our lives we've been developing mindfulness, but we've been developing what Buddhists would call wrong mindfulness. It's very easy for us to focus our attention on stimulating experiences, to be mindful of such things, but it's very difficult for us then to decide that we're going to be concern ourselves solely with something which is not stimulating, which is really quite boring. Breathing is not interesting. It can be, but in the beginning it's just, well, phew. 5 minutes of that, maybe one meditation session is quite enjoyable, the second one is not so enjoyable, so your mind begins to lose its ability to be mindful of breathing very quickly. When you've been doing it for a few days, and it's quite difficult to fix your attention on the breathing for any length of time at all. Unless you're willing to do some study and learn a few things about how the mind works. And we'll give you that kind of information during the course of this retreat also. So mindfulness is not something you have to get from somewhere. You have it already. It's just a question of sort of modifying your mindfulness. Learning to be mindful in a different way of different things. Instead of the usual stimulating things, exciting things that we would normally seek because they're enjoyable, you're going to be asked to sit still in the sand and just observe in and out breathing or the movement of your feet, depending on what kind of meditation you're doing at the time. You see, you're going against here straight away, there's always bound to be problems because we create habit patterns quite easily. Human beings are very good at this. We create obvious habit patterns and not so obvious habit patterns. And not so obvious habit patterns are the patterns of the mind. The mind gets used to being stimulated. The mind is basically what we are. We say we get used to being stimulated, but it's really the mind that's being stimulated. So it develops a habit of seeking that kind of experience. And human beings generally throughout our lives we do very little else other than seek delightful, stimulating things. And when you come here, you're not going to do that. So again, you see, this makes meditation difficult to do. Because you're going against your own habits. Habit patterns can be very strong. They force us to live in a certain way, and mostly we're unconscious of that. We just follow our habits without really questioning them. Now you're going to have to do that. Now obviously, it's not going to be easy to do. It can be done. Now you can, if you feel the need to do it. So you certainly need some motivation if you're going to even begin to get meditation to work. You're going to get meditation to work, you'll need to be motivated. You'll need to have some fairly strong desire to get your mind to move in a different direction to the one it's been used to moving in. These kind of retreats, especially this one, which is quite liberal as retreats go, always well attended, so Amok is quite a famous place. It's been around a long time too, this retreat, 30 odd years, I think, maybe more. There are always people who drop out quite quickly. And the reason is that they simply can't function in this kind of environment. They got so used to being stimulated and to experiencing life as they would normally live it, that to change the way they live is too much of an effort, and so they quit quite quickly. The majority of people, of course, don't do this, but there are always people who do. That's not a condemnation, that's just a fact of life. For some of us, it's very difficult to change our habit patterns. We find it almost impossible. And to simply sit still and do nothing but watch breathing is an impossibility for such people. Usually for the first few days you lose a few retreatants, drift off, and go to the places where they'll be more at home. Usually places like Samui or Kangan or some similar place where there's plenty going on. Lots of distractions for the mind. Lots of things which are nice and easy to be mindful of and which stimulate because of that. Meditation is not easy. So we should ask ourselves before we even begin, do we really want to do it? How strong is our need to meditate? Why are we doing it? If you're just here to see what it's all about, then it's likely that you're going to have a tough time very quickly. It's likely that you might not have a tough time. Also, it's possible, but it's likely for someone who's just wandered in here to experience this Suamok business and see what this Buddhism and this meditation is all about without really being that interested or that bothered. It might be difficult for such a person to get anything at all out of a meditation retreat or to even survive the first few days. I changed my lifestyle a long time ago when I was a hedonist, that is, I sought, like everybody else, the things that stimulate. I had my own way of doing it. I come from the generation which spawned the hippies. I was one. That's a long time ago, 1960s, into the early 70s, before the hardcore hippies decided that the whole thing was finished and had become too commercialized. It was time to find some other way of amusing ourselves. You used to go to India and stuff like that. It was a very hedonistic style of life. Always dropping out of things. College graduates didn't graduate and stayed for a time and dropped out. They were being encouraged to do this and go and live on beaches in India. Fort Aguado and Juna Beach in Goa in India was very popular at that time. But I changed that lifestyle some years into my life. I must have been about 30, I should imagine, before I really felt the need to make changes to the way I was living and became very dissatisfied with what I was and with the state of my life. I was beginning to have a lot of anger and irritation, and this was becoming continuous. And that's basically when I began to really think about life and start to change. It's when I began to experiment with different forms of meditation. You see, I didn't hear about it. I kind of invented my own meditation. I needed some way to deal with the state of my mind. And there was Christianity. I looked into that. Didn't seem to have much of an answer, but Buddhism seemed to, and some of the Hindu teachings also I found very useful. So I really felt the need to change. Eventually I finished up dressed like this. I didn't quite intend to do that, but sometimes when you, I won't go into that. But you can. And being a monk is a useful thing for someone who's interested in the Buddhist teaching and likes to practice, which I do. Both of those apply to me. So this kind of life to me is ideal. I never get bored, even though for long periods of time I'm watching my breathing or I'm translating Buddha Dasa from Thai into English. It's always Dharma stuff I'm translating. There's nothing exciting about it, but it fascinates me. It's what I like to do. So for me, such a change was comparatively easy because I felt the need to do it. I still had problems getting meditation to work for many years. It's not a panacea to feel the need to change your life, but it's necessary if you're going to continue with your meditation practice until you finally manage to conquer the process and it really begins to work and to work very easily for you. So if you just come in here to see what it's about, then you're going to have problems for sure. But if you already are changing your life, becoming a different kind of person because you feel the need to live in a different way, then probably your meditation during the course of a retreat like this can bring quite a decent result. In some cases, quite a startling result. But you need motivation. Now, motivation, according to Buddhists, always comes from one place, the same place. they have a word, not just the Buddhists, but also the Hindus. The Christians have their own word also. The Muslims too, the Islam people have their own word for it. The Buddhists use the word dukkha. Dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A in the Pali spelling. Basically means anything unpleasant. But the sort of dukkha that we should be concerned with, we should have some knowledge of, or we should try and gain some knowledge of, is the excessive mental disturbance that every human being lacking knowledge is going to be prone to. Because this is really what meditation grows from, an understanding that you have this problem and you'd like to do something about it, as with me. In my case, it showed itself as an excess of anger and irritation. Feelings of dissatisfaction were constantly with me. This is dukkha. Mental disturbance of a kind that really I didn't need to have, but of which I had a lot, made me into a meditator, into a, what you might call, religious person. This is always the motivator, something like this. It may not be anger, but you may be aware that something is not the way it should be. And you usually find, once you investigate, that you have a mind full of noise. You don't need to have a mind full of noise. This is the Buddha's point. It's what meditation is for. That's where your motivation will come from, some knowledge of this problem. You won't call it dukkha, you may not even know what it is, but you'll feel the need to change, and this is what will make you feel the need to change. The different levels of dukkha, but the one that matters is one they call suffering. It's usually translated as suffering. It's a little bit strong as a translation, actually. It's not really that accurate, I feel. Although in my case, certainly, it has some degree of accuracy. Having a lot of anger and irritation is a lot of suffering. But generally, it's not like that for people. And there are other ways the mind can be disturbed, which are much more subtle. You're going to come up against them. In fact, you already have. You've only been here one day or half of a day or whatever it is, not very long. You've probably all already experienced the fact that your mind is not something that becomes still very easily, that it wanders a lot. It does this anyway, whether you're trying to meditate or not. But usually during life, we've got other things to busy ourselves with. We live in a society, maybe in a city, we have an occupation or profession or job of some kind. We come into contact with people and things all the time, so we perhaps don't realize that our mind is kind of fractured and always wandering, always drifting around from one thought to another, from one idea to another, from one memory to another. There's no real mental stability there. And there should be, say the Buddhists. The human mind should not be in this condition. But you're bound to notice this when you come to a retreat. It'll be one of the first forms of dukkha that you will recognize. Because it is an unpleasant thing when you recognize it truly. Excuse me. Well, you might have a lazy mind, a dull, dead, lazy mind. You perhaps also suffer from this during normal life. But when you come here, it will be more obvious. You're sitting, but you don't feel like doing it. You kind of have the idea you want to meditate, but suddenly you've lost your energy. Your mind is sleepy and tired and lazy. And so you feel physically the same. You feel physically sleepy, tired and lazy. You may not have experienced this one yet. You haven't been here long enough. But you will. Mind without energy. Excuse me a moment. I need to lubricate my throat. Or you might have a very negative mind, which was my problem in days gone by. Not so much these days, but I've managed to understand it and control it. But in days gone by, my mind was always negative. That is, it was always inclining to irritation, and sometimes very easily falling into anger because of that. A feeling of dissatisfaction is always at the bottom of that. You may have this, so you may come, you want to meditate, but the mind is not in the mood to do it. It's negative. Always on the verge of being irritated by something, being bothered by something. We may have too much of what they call lust. Your mind might be lustful. desiring to be stimulated. This is something we do most of our lives, seek stimulation. So you shouldn't be surprised if when you come here, the mind still wants to do the same thing. This is known as a lustful mind, stimulating. The stimulation is it creates a lustful mind. Well, you might have a lot of doubt and confusion, which is not unusual either, given the way we live normally. All these things are forms of dukkha on a very gentle, more acceptable level. We have them all our lives. For some of us, some of these are chronic. And for most of us, they're tolerable. They're not that much of a disturbance. But they can become big problems, and often do, if you don't know how to control them, if you don't understand them. This is dukkha on a very obvious, well, very gentle level. Perhaps not so obvious. When you come to a meditation retreat, you're bound to experience this kind of thing. The question is, does that mean anything to you as a human being? If it does, and if you'd like to get rid of it, or get it under control so your mind isn't so negative perhaps, if that is indeed a problem, or isn't so lustful, or isn't so doubtful and confused, or doesn't wander so much, doesn't lack energy so often. If you'd like to have a bright, clear mind most of the time, then you're probably going to have the motivation to really get your meditation to work. Dukkha is something we should understand because we have it all the time. Mostly in the milder forms I've mentioned, but it can be much heavier than that, obviously. What we're getting round to here is the real cause, the real purpose of meditation, is to destroy this problem. But it has a deeper problem hidden behind it. It has a basic cause. The wandering mind, the restless mind, the dull and drowsy mind, the lustful, the hateful mind, they all have a deeper cause. They come, what from one source, they come from a lack of knowledge concerning what we are. This is what the Buddhists tell us. And now you come to the real root of meditation practice. This is what it's basically for. The idea is that by using meditation, by getting the mind to be peaceful, still, and quiet, and calm, we can experience the truth of what we actually are. Whereas if we don't do that, we're never going to know our true nature, ever. And we'll go around thinking that this is me, right throughout our lives, and if there is a future life, right throughout that one too. If you think that there's a you living life, and everybody does, of course, then naturally you're going to have a lot of problems that you don't need to have. And the Buddhist says, just an idea is not a real thing at all. But it's something we believe is real. And so it brings us into contact with life on a very different level. It's me who's experiencing life. And this is why we have all those mental problems I just mentioned. Because the ups and downs of life, the experiences of life, the pleasant, the unpleasant, we experience this naturally. Can't avoid that. That's being alive. But if you think it's you who's living life, then it's you who's experiencing the ups and downs of life. And so you get the mental disturbances we just mentioned. The mind becomes restless easily. The mind is sometimes doubtful, often confused. The mind is negative, the mind is positive. The mind is always moving, always shifting. It's never at peace because we think it's me living life. It's all happening to me. Something pleasant makes us what we call happy, stimulates the mind in a particular way. Causes a certain kind of desire to arise, to increase the stimulation. Something unpleasant happens, it stimulates the mind in a different way, we call it depression. You might be afraid or something like that, you might experience fear. And the mind is always being moved in ways it doesn't need to be moved. It's always unstable, never really peaceful. Not so easy to understand on some levels because we experience a lot of things that make us what we would call happy. But Buddhists who really understand happiness would say, well, what you experience is mental disturbance, really. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, you're better off without it. And you can be without it, although being without happiness might not sound too attractive until you actually experience that state, which your meditation practice can introduce you to. And then perhaps you'd agree with the Buddhists. This is what meditation is basically for then. It's designed by the Buddha, Anapanasati, to destroy the self-illusion. The illusion that this is me, if it is an illusion. It's because the Buddhists say it is, doesn't mean that it's true. Might be true, might not be. Up to us to discover for ourselves these things. And the way we do that is by practicing meditation. Now, Anapanasati is said to come from Siddhartha Gautama, who in days gone by, before he became a Buddha, was some kind of royal personage, said to have been a prince. This is apocryphal, it's not true in the proper sense. It's probably not entirely untrue, because I did some investigation into this kind of thing. Not especially into the Buddha's origins. But I did discover that the area of India he was born into was not just what you might call one state or one country. The system he was born into, the social system he was a part of, it seems to have been a republic or a federation of some kind. These were quite common in India 3,000-4,000 years ago. They did have states which were not monarchical. They weren't dominated by a king or a queen. Some of them were genuine republics. And apparently the Buddha, or Siddhartha Gautama as he was then, came from such a place. So the idea that he was a prince comes from a misunderstanding of this. His father was probably some kind of tribal leader. And he would have had the right to call himself a Raja, or Maharaja even. But it wouldn't have meant king in the normal sense, the sense that we would understand a king as being a ruler. His father was probably one of the influential persons in a particular system, in a particular republic or federation of states. And there would have been many such, and these would have come from the rich and powerful, obviously. These are the ones who made the decisions and guided the whole republic in a certain direction. So any of those people, and there have been hundreds of them, had the right to call themselves Raja. It was probably something like being called a lordship in England, or a knighthood. You call yourself Sir This or Sir That. It doesn't mean that much. And Raja probably had the same meaning in the Buddha's time, in the area that he was living in. So prince, I think not. Prince implies some kind of royal lineage. I think this is a fallacy. And it seems to be so from modern scholarship, modern investigation. Whatever he was, he was certainly born, and he certainly experienced the problems of dukkha, and he did in his case. They were severe enough in his case to make him seek a way out from the problems of life. Now he understood to some extent, because the Hindus did, that the problem of the self idea was already known. It's not an invention of the Buddhists. It predates Buddhism. Ancient Hindus know full well that self was a problem. It did create unnecessary problems in the human life. It just had a different way of understanding it. As far as the Hindus are concerned, the ancient ones, there's no way you could destroy selfishness completely. You couldn't get rid of the feeling of me totally. What you could do is you could absorb it into the great me, the great self. They had a word, Atman, basically meant self. But there was a great Atman and there was a small Atman. And we all have this small Atman, which is something like a spirit, if you like. This is a Hindu belief, not a Buddhist belief. And the idea was, as far as the Hindus were concerned at that time, that you could, by using certain methods of practice, you could get the small Atman to kind of merge with the great Atman. And this would then have been their understanding, the limit of their understanding. As far as they were concerned, this was the best you could do. There's no way you could overcome the feeling of being me totally. They would not have subscribed to the Buddhist belief that it's a total illusion. There really isn't anything called me in a human being. That's not to say that there isn't anything selfish about a human being, because a human creature, like all things, has a survival instinct, and this is essentially selfish. But it's not an ego or a self or a soul or a spirit. And the Atman is something which abides in the Hindu understanding. That is, it will last for many, many million years, depending on the individual, on how long it takes them to become what they call enlightened. When the person becomes enlightened, they realize the truth of what they are. And then they realize, in the Hindu sense, that they are the great Atman, they're just some small particle of the great God, the great being. They then merge with great Atman, and that's the end of that. No more mental problems, because they get rid of the self. On the small sense, they no longer feel that this is me. It's part of the great void, the great Atman. And the Buddhists don't quite see it in the same way, although not so very different. But that was a belief at the time of the Buddha, anyway. It didn't satisfy him, obviously, because He practiced certainly meditation. He got from different people meditation techniques because he felt the need to practice. As mentioned, he was a royal personage, so say, or at least rich and influential, came from a very rich family background. But even so, he still experienced problems in his life which he wanted to get rid of. And these made him then therefore seek. Eventually he gave up his affluent lifestyle and became a wandering ascetic, wandering around in northern India, as a lot of people did in those days, looking for the way out from the problems of life which he experienced. And he went to different people, tried different techniques, before he eventually invented his own, which is essentially where Anapanasati comes from. You see, the belief was, the understanding was, that you could eventually merge the small self with the great self, but actually getting rid of it in the sense of destroying the feeling of egoity, that this is me, was an impossibility as far as the ancient Hindus were concerned. You couldn't really do that. The best you could hope for was to merge yourself with the great being. And this would have been more or less what Siddhartha would have understood in his youth. This would have been the understanding he would have been saddled with. For some reason it didn't satisfy him because he experimented with meditation, became quite the adept. But notice that although he could develop very deep levels of concentration, when you do this, you can more or less put the self-feeling to sleep. And for the time you're fully concentrated, as anybody who can concentrate the mind decently would know, there's no feeling of being me, there's no feeling of separation. And so life is obviously very different then. It's a blissful experience for that reason. There's no dukkha, because there's no me experiencing life. There's no me to experience the mental disturbance. Life becomes very peaceful and calm, but only while you're deeply concentrated. Of course, when you come out of that kind of concentration, you feel very different, but only for a time. It gradually loses its ability to charm. The feeling of being very elevated, it disappears sooner or later. The feeling of being void of self, of not having a me, that gradually disappears in the self-sense, reasserts itself. Our old habits of mind just come back sooner or later. So just by concentrating the mind, you can escape from selfishness, and you can experience what it means to be without the feeling of self. But really only when you're fully concentrated is this really potent. When you come out of full concentration, as Siddhartha Gautama discovered, well, you're back in the same place, basically. Okay, you don't feel the same, but sooner or later you will feel the same. Unless you just meditate all the time. So he decided, well, this is fine, but you know, there must be something more than this. This can't be the only. There must be some way of destroying this self-understanding and getting rid of the dukkha completely. This can't be all there is. This is silly. It's just that nobody's discovered it yet. So he went on seeking. He tried all sorts of things. He tried meditation techniques, yes, and they made him into a concentrated, great concentrator of the mind. Eventually he even tried ascetic practices, which is involved, give the body a lot of pain. Sitting in painful positions, walking about your arm over your head, or one leg tied up or whatever, all very strange stuff. Pretending to be an animal and crawling about on all fours for years, taking food from the ground and from scraps thrown out by people. Very strange. Ascetic practices causing yourself extreme discomfort. The idea being that you have the problems you have in this life because of the way you behaved in previous lives. You've made certain patterns in your previous lives which are now causing you problems in this life. And the idea was that by causing yourself extreme problems, you could use up all this, what they call bad karma, in a short space of time, and in some way, therefore, become enlightened. Not a very true understanding, apparently. But Siddhartha Gautama did also practice these kinds of things, ascetic practices of various kinds, before he realized that this was not going anywhere. And on one famous occasion, he almost starved himself to death practicing ascetic practices, so decided because of that this was obviously a waste of time. I mean, being dead, well, it's okay, but you go nowhere when you're dead, unless you believe you're going to be reborn. So what he did eventually was he invented his own practice. He took the basics of the meditation practices he'd been taught, the useful bits, bits that concentrate and make the mind peaceful. And he sat down one night, And he tried a different technique, which he'd already contemplated to some extent. It's obvious enough. He'd already worked it out. And what he did was he actually sat under a tree in northern India one moonlit night, and instead of concentrating his mind very deeply to put the self to sleep, so he could experience that uplifted, blissful state, he didn't do that. He just sat and he observed how his mind responded to the things he was hearing, for instance, or smelling, or seeing. It was from this source that a form of meditation called insight meditation is said to have been born. The Pali term for insight meditation is vipassana. And this is also part of the practice of anapanasati. Some people say the Buddha invented it according to this explanation he did. I'm not sure that's true, but it would seem to be reasonable to say it. On the night of his enlightenment, this is what he did. He tried everything else. He tried deep concentration. He tried ascetic practices. He nearly starved himself to death on one famous occasion. And so he thought, well, let's try something a little different. I'll just observe how life functions. I get my mind reasonably concentrated, not too deeply. I'm just quiet and calm enough for me to be able to observe what happens when I see something or hear some music, for instance. And it was by doing that that he actually discovered the way that the self-sense, the illusory self-sense, was created by the mind. He actually saw that it was when, for instance, listening to some really beautiful or stimulating piece of music, which is quite a lot in India, always has been, he saw that the mind, as it responded to that with desire, you know, the sort of desire it was experiencing, was created the feeling of me. As it was experiencing the music, listening to the music, the mind was creating the me, was actually listening to it. He discovered this. Of course, an amazing thing to discover, because we always think the self is always here. There's always a me. We're born with it, we die with it. It dies with us and perhaps gets reborn in some sense. So it's quite a shock for him to realize that the self-sense was not what he thought. It was not a reality. It was something that came from certain responses to certain kinds of experiences. So he kept on observing for a long time, I think 7 days altogether, until he was fully convinced that he discovered the mechanism that created the feeling of me. And it was just a thought. Just a thought that came in, accompanied any kind of stimulating experience. Anything that stimulated. If it was unwisely responded to, this is what created the feeling of self. It's a very simple thing to understand. Not so easy to see. But it can be experienced if your meditation is good enough. And from that point on, that's more or less what turned him into a Buddha, because once he understood what created the feeling of me, then all he had to do was stop that from happening. Stop it from happening completely, that was the trick. And that's what he managed to do. Once he did, once he destroyed the illusory feeling of being me, then that's when he became a Buddha. That's when all the dukkha of life disappeared from his life. And he gained that which he sought to gain. There haven't been too many people since who've actually done this deliberately in the way that the prince did. There have been a few enlightened creatures around. In fact, there are lots of enlightened beings in this world. Many more than you might think. But none of them are fully enlightened, at least as far as I'm aware. What became of Prince Siddhartha Gautama when he experienced in this way, when he developed this kind of meditation technique, was full awakening. He understood himself fully and completely. It wasn't a partial awakening or a flash of insight. He developed his mind to such an extent from his exertions previously that he was able to concentrate the mind very easily to a decent level. Not enormous level, but a decent level. And hold it there for long, long periods of time. So he could experience in this quiet mind how life actually worked. He could see it clearly after a time. He was able to do this. And if you can do the same thing, and anapanasati is designed to enable you to do the same thing, then you can do what the prince did. You can become a Buddha. I think most people probably thinking about being a Buddha, well, it seems reasonable enough. I think it's beyond most of us. Well, you can get a lot more from meditation than turning yourself into a Buddha. But you see, this is what meditation is for. And so this is why you use a technique like breathing as your meditation object, because it pacifies the mind. And the idea is that the more quiet and calm the mind is, the more it will reflect reality. So if you really get your mind into a decent state of concentration, if you get your mind into full concentration, and then bring it back out of full concentration, carefully enough to keep the effects of full concentration, that is, the mind is peaceful and still, that's the trick of full concentration, that's the beauty of it, to enter that peaceful place. Normally people just stay there, but if you can come out again and keep the effect, keep that feeling of elevation, of peaceful and calm and calmness, then you can use that mind state to observe life and to see the truth of what's really going on. The mind is like a mirror, it's been compared to a mirror. If the mirror is dirty or is in some way unstable, it's not fixed properly, so it vibrates or something, or it's moving all the time, you can't possibly experience anything as it truly is in such a thing. But if you can get the mirror of the mind to be completely still and silent and pure and clean, then it can reflect truth. Then whatever you experience, you will experience as it truly is. And if you turn the mirror of your mind on yourself, or on the mind itself, then the mind is going to realize that what is here is not me. And that will be the end of the story. Self-sense will be destroyed, all the suffering, all the dukkha will disappear. And the experience then is a completely different experience of life. And this is what meditation is for. To achieve this, you don't need an enormous level of concentration. Concentration has never been the main part of practice, of meditation practice, though most people think it is. It's certainly necessary, but not as necessary as you might think. What's necessary is mindfulness. It's the thing you're always developing, the ability to be mindful. Whatever meditation practice you take up, you'll find you need to do this, whatever technique you use. And certainly this is very obvious in breathing techniques. You have to be able to pay attention to the process of breathing continuously, without losing it, without letting the mind wander at all. It's only when you can do that, that concentration will really start to build. Once the mind can continuously observe an object to the point where it becomes interested in it, then it becomes truly continuous. Then your mindfulness becomes perfect, the mind stays with the object, and that's when concentration starts to grow. That will never happen if your mindfulness is not strong enough to make it happen. So mindfulness is always the main thing, particularly in Buddhism. That's why anapanasati is called anapanasati. Mindfulness with breathing. It doesn't mention concentration at all in the title. Mindfulness is always the main thing. Well, that's what meditation is for. 100%. That's the ultimate meaning of life as far as meditation is concerned. To understand ourselves properly. As long as we don't, we'll think there's a me living life and we'll always have problems. The human society will always have problems, and the world that we occupy, the human part of the world, will always be in turmoil. There'll always be wars and problems and weird things happening. Because we're all in the same boat. We all have the same idea that this is me, a greater or lesser extent. Some of us know that it's not a true thing. Very few of us really understand it fully in the way the Buddha did, if any at all. That's what it's for. You can use meditation for other purposes, of course, but you'll really always be doing the same thing. You see, if you just want to concentrate, you're not too interested in destroying selfishness. You don't see that that's necessary. But if you can concentrate the mind will only concentrate because the self-sense has been put to sleep. So you'll be doing the same thing, basically, when you sit and get the mind really fully concentrated, so it goes into full concentration. The self-sense is gone. There is no sense of being different from the world you live in. That's why it's such a blissful experience. As long as we think there's a me, there's always going to be some mental dissonance. The mind will always be out of tune with itself. There'll always be some problem. And once you concentrate the mind, the self-sense, it goes to sleep just for a time. And that dissonance is gone, the dukkha is gone. And so the experience is very different. So if you just want to concentrate the mind to some degree, you'll still be doing much the same thing. You'll be putting the self-sense to sleep. You'll be using the same technique to get the same result. Just in your case, the result won't be a permanent result. You might just want to get rid of some of the problems of life. Again, you'll be doing much the same thing though, because all the problems of life come from an excess of selfishness, which is what self-belief is. Whenever you concentrate the mind to any level, just get it reasonably quiet and calm and peaceful without being deeply concentrated at all, you cause the self-sense to diminish. Selfishness feeds, according to Buddhism, on experiences that stimulate. This is what the Buddha discovered. So if you deny yourself these experiences, if you keep away from them, and this is where the motivation becomes really necessary, that is, if you can change your lifestyle permanently so you don't always seek the things you once did. This tends to happen to people naturally, I think, rather than forcing it to happen. So suddenly you feel different about life and you no longer want to do the same things. You don't want to go to the pub drinking beer or going to discos or watching television all the time or whatever it is you like doing. You find yourself, your mind begins to move in a very different direction. But you can make this happen anyway, but you still need the motivation to some extent. Mindfulness will certainly allow you to live life in a more careful, balanced and controlled way. There are different results from meditation depending on what we want, but they all really are difficult to achieve because you have to conquer the mental problems we've mentioned. You have to do something about the habits of mind that you've formed during the course of your life. You have to get the mind to move in a different direction. Whether you want to be a Buddha, or whether you just want a little peace and quiet, or a little control over the way you live life, you're going to have to live differently to achieve that. What goes hand in glove with meditation always is some form of restraint in the way we live. Every religious system, doesn't matter what it is, has its precepts, its commandments. They tell you how you should live as a human being, basically. And certainly if you want your mind to meditate easily, then you're going to have to pay attention to the way you live your life. In this place in the evenings, there's chanting. And they will chant the precepts, what the Buddhists call precepts. There are basically five of these. And they're common to all religions. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not do this, that, and the other. You shalt steal and have unnecessary sexual relations and all this kind of thing. It means keeping your life under control. It's one of the prerequisites for successful meditation practice. You can't ignore it. You can, but at your peril. To have any chance of getting your mind to become stable and calm and peaceful, you really have to live life in a stable, calm and peaceful way first. And we'll get to take a deeper look at that tomorrow when we describe the actual technique of anapanasati. We're not going to take forever to do that, because it's really quite simple to explain. Although it can be a little complicated in Buddhadasa's rendering. What we've done today is just opened the practice up a bit. Explain why it exists, where it comes from, what it's for. Ultimately to destroy the feeling of me that we are stuck with from our earliest childhood. Because the Buddha says, not a real thing. You can actually trace its origins, and we'll do all these things during the course of the next few days. That can be quite interesting, and quite controversial too. But we'll look at the meditation technique itself tomorrow. We'll look at the first four steps of the practice of anapanasati, and we'll spend some time over those. There are actually 16 steps of this practice altogether, but we're not going to burden you with lots of information about stuff you may never get around to practicing. But we'll take a quick look at the 16 steps, and we'll take a slightly deeper look at the final four steps of the practice, because that is where what they call enlightenment experience occurs. So that's always moderately interesting to listen to. But we'll pay most attention to the first four steps of the practice, all of which involve breathing, and so they're approachable. The other parts of the practice require other meditation objects that you have to achieve. The first four steps give you the meditation object for the second four steps, but you have to be successful in the first four steps before you get the meditation object for the second four steps. It's a bit like a computer game. You have to beat the aliens in the first level before you get more interesting aliens in the second level. And anapanasati works much the same way. That's probably where computer games came from. So that's enough of that. You've already been given some instruction. You have that pamphlet, a little on how to meditate, which is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not anapanasati, that's all. That's okay. the actual meditation, the instruction you've been given, I think Werner probably talked to you to some extent about that. I'm not really going to add much to what he said, but I'm going to introduce you to a different form of meditation also. We'll do that tomorrow. So the meditation you've been given is fine. We'll expand it a little bit as a meditation technique, but we'll also look at a different form of meditation, all of which is part of Anapanasati, but we'll do that tomorrow. So I'm going to ring the bell. It's enough talking. And when I do, it's time to go and do some walking. So you get up and you go to your place of walking, wherever it is you've chosen to walk. Walk backwards and forwards for a certain length of time until the big bell rings. The big bell will ring 3 times. And then you come back and you sit in the sand once more and start to try and quiet your mind down, get your mind under control. Now you're here to do a meditation retreat, so as we mentioned, mindfulness is what it's all about. This is always the main thing. But it's not something that you can, it's not like going to school and doing your lessons and then forgetting about school when the lesson is over. And you're here for 11 days and it is a retreat. You can turn the whole period that you're actually in this place into a meditation retreat. And you can, because it's mindfulness you're developing. You're developing it on the in and out breathing primarily, on the movement of your feet when you walk. But you've also today been, you've eaten, so you've been given the food reflection to read, which reminds you how you should respond to food. That is, you should be mindful of the process of eating food. And not eat it to be delighted by it, but simply eat it for the purposes provided. This involves the development of mindfulness. Whatever you do in life, you can use as a practice to increase your ability to be mindful of life, to be aware of what you're doing in the moment that you do it. And while you're here, you'll still be alive, you'll still be going to the toilet, brushing your teeth, taking a bath, doing all sorts of things. There are lots of different things you can use as meditation objects for development of mindfulness on. Not just breathing and walking. Practically anything you do while you're in this place, like now when I ring the bell, you're going to stand up and you're going to move away. So instead of just standing up any old how, you can stand up carefully and be aware of the movement of your body as you stand up. And then as you walk to the place you're going to walk backwards and forwards in, you can also be mindful of walking there. Not just become mindful when you get to the place and start walking. You can turn the whole thing into a meditation retreat if you want, if you feel inclined to try and do that. Of course you fail, but at least you make the effort. The meditation retreat is not just a series of lessons. It lasts for 10 days, 11 days or whatever. And to really get full benefit from it, you should attempt to be mindful the whole time that you're here. And don't worry too much if you can't do that. Very few people can, but you can learn to do it. So, have a nice day.